Welcome to the fourth quarter 2019 market update conference call. My name is Adrienne, and I'll be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session. During the question-and-answer session, if you have a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. Please note this conference is being recorded. And I'll turn the call over to Paul Lonergan. Paul, you may begin.
Thanks, Adrienne. I want to welcome everyone to our fourth quarter call, which I always think is our first quarter call, because I don't know if we're backward-looking or forward-looking, but hopefully Rich will give you a little bit of perspective on where we've been and where we're going. Before beginning the call, I want to remind all participants that on this call, we will make forward-looking statements that involve various risks and uncertainties. When we use words as believe, expect, anticipate, will, intend, and the like, we are identifying and making forward-looking statements. Any forward-looking statements made during this presentation are subject to the safe harbor provisions of the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. All participants on the call are invited to review CWM's Form ADV, which is available at www.sec.gov, as well as on the CWM website. So, thank you. And I'm here joined by Ken Zanoni and Rich Barrett in what is known as our Zoom room, which is part of our new office, and showing off some of the technology that we've put in place to be able to be able to work with and communicate with and meet with and engage with a growingly national client base. So we appreciate you all joining us today. Adrienne tells me we've got a good crowd on the phone, and then, of course, the call is going to be taped as well. So as we do this call out of our new office, I invite you, if you haven't been here yet, we'd love to have you. The format today is Rich will make the body of the remarks, and then we open it up to questions. I think Ken is signaling me that he's already received a couple of questions, and then we'll open up to the line, to anyone who's got anything on their mind. So, again, an open forum, and thanks for joining us. Rich?
Great. Thanks, Paul, and thanks to all of our clients and partners on the phone. We can kind of dive right in. I'll make kind of some broad comments about the past year, some comments about performance, and then some thoughts about where we're going in 2020 and beyond. But as my letter that came out the other day kind of summarized, you know, the big difference between 2018 and 2019, 100% of the difference is the Federal Reserve and monetary policy. 2018 was a very volatile year. The data was actually pretty good, but the markets were very volatile. And what brought on that volatility was that the Fed and other central banks around the world were taking liquidity out of the system. The Fed, for example, shrank its balance sheet by about $500 billion in 2018. They raised rates four times in 2018. The last couple of rates, the October and December rate hikes in late 2018, were really the source and underpinnings of all the year-end volatility that we experienced about 13 or 14 months ago. And really what was happening was that they were taking liquidity out of the system, but inflation was well unchecked. Under the 2% Fed threshold, they were raising rates and fighting inflation, and it didn't need to be fought. That all changed 180 degrees in 2019. The Fed went from hiking rates in December of 2018, came back 3 weeks later, said that they were on auto pause, and that led to an avalanche of very loose, very accommodative monetary policy globally in 2019. The Fed cut rates three times in the latter part of the year, actually increased the size of their balance sheet through quantitative easing, increased it about $600 billion, reinitiating quantitative easing and a loose money policy here in the U.S. Globally, the rest of the world caught on to this, and rate cuts globally accelerated in the second part of the year. There were more than 65 interest rate cuts in the second part of 2019. The big picture also is that the world is awash in liquidity. There's about $2 trillion incrementally that have gone into traditional bond products over the last 9 years. Their money supply in 2019 grew by about 8.5%. About $4 trillion went into money market funds in the last 5 years. And there's about $1.5 trillion, which has been put aside by institutions, foundations, endowments, the like, for private equity investments that has been committed but is unfunded. So as I look back at kind of 2019, the single biggest driver of, you know, why the markets did well, why risk was rewarded, was the substantial change in the direction of monetary policy, not just here in the U.S., but globally. As we look at performance for 2019, you know, markets were, risk-taking was rewarded. Bonds, the fixed income invested did very, very well, and stocks did great. The S&P 500 was up about 30% for the year. Fixed income investments were up roughly 8% for the year. You know, the strategies that we use here at Congress Wealth, you know, many of them are run by our partner company, Congress Asset Management, did very well relative to benchmarks. But we believe in cycle investing, and when you think about cycle investing, you have to start, you know, measuring over longer periods of time to really get an idea as to whether, you know, you're in the right asset class or not. So as we look back over the last 3 years, here's a snapshot of kind of broadly what markets have done. S&P 500 up 52%, developed international up 34%, emerging market equities up 39%, traditional fixed income up about 13%, cash up just under 5%. So, you know, that is a snapshot of kind of where we are. And you know, why that has occurred is that credit continues to be available and cheap. All that money that I talked about, whether it be the Fed and the global central banks, whether it be in institutions or endowments, whether it be retail investors in smaller portfolios who have money on the sidelines, that is fueling a lot of the risk-taking that's taking place, and risk assets have been rewarded. As we head into 2020, I'd offer, you know, a few thoughts, kind of broad thoughts about where I think markets are and where we're headed. The thing I'm looking for more than anything else, and I think all investors should be looking at this, is after cutting interest rates three times in 2019, what we should start to see by the middle of 2020 is the benefits of those cuts start kind of coming in terms of economic data, particularly GDP growth. I mean, if interest rates is planting the seed, the crop is the data when it ultimately comes in, and it takes about 9 months for that to occur. So as we make our way into kind of the second quarter or maybe the summer of this year, I think, you know, what are green shoots right now should really start to look a lot more robust as we think about manufacturing coming back, GDP growth in the U.S. It's hard to see the labor economy doing much better than it's doing right now, but it does continue to improve. But I think the data is what we're going to be pointing to, that is, you know, we should start seeing better data in the middle of this year, and that data should translate into better earnings. Corporate earnings in 2019 were basically flat for the year, which really seems odd when you consider that the stock market was up 30% and you had kind of flat earnings growth, but it was really the tale of two markets in earnings. The manufacturing sector underwent a recession because of the U.S. China trade negotiations, and those earnings were down double digits, and the rest of the market had up double digits, and it kind of all worked out to be zero. But, you know, what I'm looking for in 2020 is better economic data in the middle of the year, follow through on earnings. Earnings growth should start looking more like 5 to 8%, and on top of that, we're, you know, a dividend of a couple of percent. So markets generally like, you know, follow the direction of earnings, and I think 2020, and you know, for that matter, 2021 should be pretty good. That better data should also translate into a steeper yield curve. We spend a lot of time here talking about credit availability, why it's so important for economic and earnings growth, and a steeper yield curve is the underpinnings of, you know, a good economy and a good stock market and good risk takings and a low default rate environment, for that matter, in the corporate bond world. And we're starting to see the yield curve steepen up. You know, it was flat when you looked at 10-year versus 2-year treasuries back in August. And you know, there was a lot of talk about inversion and, you know, economic recession because of the trade war. And, you know, and the Fed stepped in right on cue in the second part of 19, cut rates, cut again, increased the size of the balance sheet. And that yield curve has steepened up. It's steepened up to about 30 basis points, give or take a couple of basis points on every given day. But as we make our way into 2020, the better economic data that we should see in the middle of this year, that yield curve should continue to steepen. And a steep yield curve is good for growth, good for investment, good for risk-taking, good for employment growth, good for the economy. So, you know, I think that better data, I'm going to measure it in terms of like a steeper yield curve. We're already starting to see the signs of that right now. And lastly, you know, it's kind of my annual public service announcement on volatility, because when you have, you know, when I'm talking about stock markets being up by 52% in 3 years, and last year it's up 30%, and portfolio returns here have done very, very well, let's not forget, you know, for 1 second that markets are volatile. They can turn on a dime. Markets go down 5 to 10% half a dozen times a year, and have for the last 50 years. And that's even in good environments in which economic data is good and earnings are good and yield curves are steepening and all the like. It's just that markets are finicky things sometimes. Volatility can show up for, you know, both good and bad reasons. And I think just having a perspective that, you know, where we are in the economic cycle, how to handle and think about volatility, have an appreciation of kind of what it could look like, what it has looked like historically, is just good, sound investing 101. So those are my thoughts on last year, where we are now, and where I think we're going. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Ken Zanoni, and Kenny will take us through the Q&A section.
Perfect. At this time, we'd like to open it up to the field to see if anyone has any questions.
Thank you. We'll now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. If you're using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have an audio question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone.
Rich, perhaps while we're waiting to see if anyone on the call has a question, there were a number of email questions that came in.
Okay.
Several actually had to do with global interest rates being either zero or, quite frankly, in many places, negative for that matter. And given that, is it possible that what we experienced over the last year or so with regards to the, you know, tariffs and the trade war with China, is it possible that we could have been pushed into a recession at this point and we just don't know it yet?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, when we talk about negative interest rates globally, we're talking about sovereign debt. So it's German bunds, it's yen-denominated JGBs in Japan, it's debt issued by countries. And there was a lot of it in 2019. So it got a lot of press for the first time back in 2016 when about $12 trillion of this type of debt carried a negative interest rate back in 2016. The Fed stepped in, did their magic, went on auto pause, and the market recovered. And in 2019, almost $17 trillion went negative. I don't think it's signaling a recession. I think it's signaling a very specific weakness that took place in the economy, the global economy, in 2019. And that was clearly we had a manufacturing recession. You know, the U.S.-China trade war, trade battle, trade negotiations, whatever you want to call it, that took about 9 months of negotiations, but by the middle of last year, the entire manufacturing industry was slowing down, and it didn't matter whether you were doing business in China or Germany or the U.S. You know, Germany was really the one that was caught in the crosshairs. I know I've talked about it, I think, on maybe one of the other calls and in a lot of the notes, but, like, Germany's role in the global economy is Germany's a manufacturing-based economy. They about 70% of their economy is manufacturing-based. Their number one trading partner is China, and so when we get into a battle with China, Germany's caught in the crosshairs. Their economy goes into recession. Their bonds go negative, and interest rates develop out of that. I don't think it's signaling a broad recession. I think it was very specific to the manufacturing economy. I think the data that I'm seeing right now, both on the manufacturing side and on the yield side, are starting to see that a lot of the cuts and a lot of the stimulus that was put into place in 2019, it wasn't just the U.S. that was cutting rates, it was other global central banks. That is starting to lead to an improving manufacturing position and starting to lead to modestly higher yields, even in some of these negative yielding countries. Here in the U.S., I don't think we have a recession. 70% of the economy in the U.S. is service-based. The manufacturing sector is very controlled and limited. I don't think we're going to run, an issue here in the U.S. about going to the negative yields. But in 2019, it had 100% to do with U.S. and China. I think the watered-down trade deal that I guess is going to get signed next week is step one of probably a 10-year battle. We're going to be talking about U.S.-China trade issues for the next 10 years. So, I think we'll get this question in the future because we'll be back in another manufacturing recession 3 or 4 phases from now when we've had, 2 or 3 other watered-down trade deals negotiated. But it all has to do with manufacturing. I don't think the U.S. – the data says the U.S. isn't even close to a recession.
Perfect. Before I continue, Adrian, are there any questions in the queue?
We have no questions currently in the queue, but as a reminder, if you'd like to enter the queue, please press star 1.
Okay, while we're waiting, Rich, you mentioned data. You talk a lot about fundamentals, which we know are important, but given what's going on currently with Iran, given impeachment proceedings, the upcoming election, the next stage of Brexit, there's this growing list of worries, concerns, etc. Is the fundamentals and the data that you're looking at on a regular basis, is it good enough to overcome this big list of worries that the market is looking at on a day-to-day basis?
That's a good question. I'll answer it this way. I think on any given shorter period of time, a day, a week, maybe a few weeks and stuff like that, the news cycle can overwhelm and overcome good fundamentals. But as a colleague, Mike Hardy, who works out of our Arizona office, actually sent me it's kind of a humorous picture, but it was a snapshot of what's the market done in the last 9 years and all the other crises that have occurred. And when you go through it, it's pretty staggering. Iran and impeachment and Brexit stage 5 and the elections is going to be a lot. But we had a tsunami, wipe out a Japanese nuclear reactor. We had the U.S. AAA rating debt get downgraded. We went through 3 mini recessions. We, gave birth to the idea of untested quantitative easing. We have had plenty of political drama. I guess the point of it all is there's always going to be a list of things to worry about. We try to put it in the construct of kind of how long it can last, what type of, implications they could have on the market. For example, this week I've written a couple times about Iran. It's all over the news cycle and stuff like this. But, we've had 10 rumbles with Iran dating back 70 years, and they generally kind of have a negative market implication for a week. After a month, things have kind of stabilized. After 3 months, things are better. After 6 months, markets have kind of recovered. Markets ultimately migrate back to what's most important, and what is most important is fundamentals. And the most important fundamental is whether credit's available or not. So we're going to survive Iran and the impeachment and Brexit and the election and the other 5 things we have not even thought about. But I think it's worthwhile. I'll go back to my earlier comment about volatility. It's out there. It can show up at any given moment. It's unpleasant, and nobody likes it when it occurs. But if the fundamentals that we're following are still good, those type of issues won't be powerful enough to knock over good fundamentals. Ultimately, fundamentals will win out.
Perfect. Adrian, I'll check in with you one more time.
We have no questions at this time.
And there's one more question, Rich, that kind of stood out because it was a little bit unique, had to do with demographics and demographic trends. And is that something that Congress focuses on when we look at our investment process or we make investment decisions?
We definitely look at demographic data. I worked for somebody a long time ago, and we spent, when I was in my days at Fidelity, and we did a lot of data mining about demographics and how it related to emerging markets, because it was a huge underpinning about kind of where the cycle was going to be in emerging markets. Demographics are important. I think it's important to have an appreciation, broadly speaking, about what they look like. And more importantly, how are demographics manifesting themselves in market risks and opportunities? So, like, globally, if I took a look right now, I'd say demographics in terms of aging look the worst in Japan and then Europe. And then I'd add a couple of surprises. One, China's actually very young now, but because of the one-child policy that they had in place for a long time, China gets old really, really fast in the next 25 years. I mean, I'm talking about cycle investing. I'm talking 25 years from now, what this is going to look like. It's just literally, you know, demographic math about how it plays out. But China does get old. So when you start hearing about China slowdown, China consumption patterns, what China is going to be like in the future, the China of the future is not going to be the China of the past. The China of 1990 to 2010, that China was about building roads and infrastructure and building out cities and places, and it was the transition from a rural to an urban-based economy. The China of 2020 to 2050 is going to be about an aging China, actually becoming a consumer-based economy. It's going to be the rollout of consumer finance, the use of technology, and how they're going to use credit cards and mortgages and things that we all use every single day, this kind of commonplace financial instruments. Those will all be new and introduced to China, but China gets old kind of fast. And here in the U.S., everyone's talking about how old we're getting really fast, but I'll throw it out. In the last 40 years, the year that had the most births in the U.S. was 1990. So as we look around the seaport, which has plenty of millennials right now, they're all turning 30. And what's going to happen to that group, and that's what, you know, in the last 40 years, 1990 had the highest births in the U.S. They're now 30 years old, and they're going into their prime spending age. You know, when you go to 30 to 50, there's family formation and housing formation and kids get born and swing sets need to be bought and all the stuff that goes like that. But your prime spending years are between the ages of 30 and 50. And the U.S. is a consumer-based economy. And so there's a lot of pent-up demographic demand very specifically tied to the millennials. So, you know, are the baby boomers aging? Absolutely. Are they retiring at an accelerating rate? Yes. But underneath that, in the demographics of the U.S. right now, there's a very – you know, there's a kind of a nuance going on that we're about to hit a pocket of the highest level of births in 40 years are about to all go to their prime 10 to 20 year spending pattern. And that, you know, we're a consumer based economy. That should be good for the U.S. It should be good for U.S. GDP growth. But, you know, to kind of link it back to the questions, absolutely, we think about demographics. I think it's, you know, the underpinnings of kind of broadly, you know, how economies get put together. And how are they manifesting itself? You know, aging demographics in places like Europe and Japan have anchored rates at zero. You know, they are net savers, and so they're natural buyers, an older population, natural buyers of fixed income instruments. And so when you have Japan and Europe demographically anchored, as they are, and interest rates there are going to be low for a really long period of time, it's hard to see interest rates globally all of a sudden spiking to any sort of unusual level. But I think demographics and interest rates and kind of broadly speaking, you know, future consumer spending are absolutely tied together. We think about them, read about them all the time. They do factor in as kind of how, broadly speaking, how we think about asset allocation and putting portfolios together for clients.
That was all the questions we had. Adrian, I don't know if there's any last-minute questions waiting on the line.
We have no audio questions.
Okay. I did want to just make one more notification. This will be the last time we do the quarterly call in this specific format. Going forward, we'll be using part of our new technology, using a webinar. So the format for sending out information on how to dial in will be exactly the same. The difference will be there will be a link to click on, which will allow you to see us as well as to see any of the data or information that we decide to share on our screen. If you are a listener that typically does not is not in front of a computer screen while you're listening, you'll still have the ability to dial in a listen-only basis.
Okay, we're up against the half hour. Rich, enjoyed your comments. If anyone has questions, feel free to email or let us know. We look forward to seeing you at your next review. And thanks, as always. We appreciate the trust that you place in us. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.